Now I have the honor of introducing Amelia Jones, who will be moderating, acting as respondent for this session. Amelia Jones is professor and Grierson Chair in Visual Culture at McGill University in Montreal. She has organized exhibitions on contemporary art and on feminism, queer, and anti-racist approaches to visual culture. Her recent publications include the edited volumes Feminism and Visual Culture Reader, 2003, with a new edition in 2010, and a companion to contemporary art since 1945-2006. Following on her body art, performing the subject 1998, Jones's single authored books include Irrational Modernism, A Neuroesthetic History of New York Dada, 2004, and Self-Image, Technology, Representation, and the Contemporary Subject, 2006. Her current projects are an edited volume, Perform, Repeat, Record, Live Art and History with co-editor Adrian Heathfield, and a book tentatively entitled Seeing Differently, Identification and the Visual Arts. Thanks, Amelia.
Thanks to Laura and to Luminato and PSI for inviting me, which made it possible for me to come and do what I think will be a very interesting dialogue today, and to see the wonderful Ship of Fools, which, for everyone who hasn't seen it yet, I think this will set the stage for even greater enjoyment of the piece when you're able to get over there. It's my honor to introduce, and I'm going to introduce very briefly because I could spend probably half an hour just listing the various amazing accolades and exhibitions of Janet Cardiff and George Burris Miller. So I'm just briefly going to say, most of you probably know their work already. They've shown individual and collaborative works all over the world, from Japan to Berlin to London, and of course to Toronto, since the early 1990s. Their work has been extensively documented on their website and through catalogs produced in relation to exhibitions. And in researching this dialogue, I read dozens and dozens of critical articles as well, and it really struck me that there's a level of very intelligent discourse surrounding their work, which I think is tribute to the intelligence of their practice. They're considered among the most important artists working across new media, addressing issues of space, time, and embodiment in the world today. Extending and expanding the legacies of conceptualism, sound art, performance, and body art, installation, artist video, and film. And I think I want to just tell a very brief anecdote about what happened to me yesterday when I went to see Janet's piece, Whispering Room, which is up right across the way at the Art Gallery of Ontario. I was very excited. I paid my whopping $18. I was ritually harassed by the guards and had to check my bag, and so I was already a little bit on edge. Nonetheless, still very excited. Went into the piece, and I was trying to hear the sound, which is obviously a very important component of the piece, as well as to see the projected video. Or film, rather, and there was a very large guard talking very loudly whose body was entirely blocking the projected image. And he was talking to a colleague in the middle of this space. And so I gently, because I was standing behind him, touched his arm, and I said, "Excuse me, would you mind moving somewhere else so I could actually see the piece?" And then, thinking nothing of it, he kind of left the room, came back a minute later, and said, "I could accuse you of harassment and assault. You know, I just want you to know that you never touch a guard like that. And you came at me from behind, and you assaulted me." And I'm telling this story both maybe to raise the specter of how difficult it is to make immersive work that actually, you know, there's a lot of factors involved. There are, you know, issues of embodiment, phenomenological questions, issues of how you're addressing a spectator or participant. And then, of course, as this guard pointed out to me, there are potentially legal issues.
That's the danger of rhetoric, huh?
Oh, my God. I did tell him in so many words to, I think I said, get a life. But I think I wanted to tell that story both to remind everyone also that there's a Janet Cardiff piece at the AGO, and also
just don't talk to the guards.
Yeah, just don't, and by all means, don't touch them. And to raise, I think we talked about kind of looking at their work as a setup for the Ship of Fools in terms of the question both of the complexity of hybrid media that particularly in your collaborative works that you put in play, and also to address this issue of the spectator and participation and what happens with these works. And we could talk a little bit as we get to the Ship of Fools also about the audiences that are turning up for that, because I was enjoying on the opening day seeing a lot of very young children being brought through the piece. So that's my little setup, and I think now it would be, I think, really important for George and Janet to give a little bit of background on some of their works that, well, really all of them are relevant to Ship of Fools, but I think there's some that are very much leading up to this current work.
I want to segue here, though, because just the AGO guard story reminded me of something that happened to me at the AGO during the Yoko Ono exhibition there. She has the phone installed, right,
mm-hmm.
that she's going to phone the gallery and talk to somebody who's walking through. So I'm going, all right, I get to talk to Yoko today. So I'm standing there, and a guard is talking on the phone. They realized that this was an outside line that they could use to phone their friends. And he did this for like 10, 20 minutes, the whole time I was there. So, and I'm sure Yoko's phoning, and she's like, my phone is busy? What is... How can this be?
Someone anyway. Needs to talk to the company that's contracting out the security guards over there.
And it all shows the complexity of what you were saying about presenting work that just doesn't hang on the wall or sit in a gallery space. And the Ship of Fools, we always hang around a piece a few days afterwards, and we sort of sit there, and we really like to control the interface, because the people who hand out our work or who manage it are so important, because it involves the spectator, but if the interface isn't right, then it's very difficult, because then they won't enjoy the piece, or then they won't see it properly and all that. So we have to sort of rely on people. We don't know how this is going to function in the future, you know, once we're not interested anymore to hang out anymore.
But, well, you were really concerned about safety issues, because there's a lot of fabulous little mechanical
parts. We just don't want to be sued, you know.
Yeah. Well, talk to the guard, because I think he's on the...
We're sending him through the ship.
Yeah, the personal...
But it was very interesting to me to be invited to a PSI, the idea of performance, because our work gets put into a lot of different contexts. I think one thing that always interested George and I, we go to, we live part-time in Berlin, and we like to go to dance performance, and sort of things that, and theater, and we get invited quite a bit in Europe to do projects with theater companies. And so their work is very much about hybrid. It's not about, sculpture or performance or anything, but...
It's not about anything.
It's been a long time since I've been out of Grindrod, BC. We live in the west of Canada in a little town, little farm outside a village or hamlet. But the thing that joins a lot of the work is the sort of idea of virtual performance. The idea, like the audio walks became quite well known and took off in Europe. And one of the things that always interests me about that was how you got a virtual connection to the artist, to myself. but I could have this sort of connection through the media. And then the people, the participants, became very integral to the piece. And I always said it's the piece the people who enjoyed the piece the most were sort of talented, I called them talented participants, because somehow they brought about coincidences. Somehow they saw the right things and they, you know, walked the pace the right and everything. Mm-hmm. Everything happened to them. And
do you feel that Ship of Fools is working in that way, that you're kind of activating the spectator or communicating in some way?
I think it involves it much more virtual.
It's a very different piece from from the walks, obviously.
It connects a lot to a piece. Our very first collaboration was Dark Pool in 1995.
Which we went to art school together, and we always worked on each other's pieces at art school, but we never thought that we were collaborating, and I guess we were in some way. And I was, Janet, I did a lot of video installation. Janet would hold the camera. I would jump up and down or whatever. And then the same with the audio walks. I would do a lot of the recording. I even would walk with the head and do some of the footsteps that you think are Janet's or me walking in Janet's shoes, which is really uncomfortable, actually. So when we came to that piece, that's 95, I guess, Dark Pool, we always talking about the projects, and there was a point with Dark Pool that we didn't know whose idea it was, and so we just decided we should do it as a collaboration. And it was kind of a nice way of working into collaborating without actually deciding we're going to become a brand or whatever and become a collaborative team. It took many years, actually. Now everything we do pretty well is collaborative. Mm-hmm. But it took many, like 10 years before that became. We still showed solo shows different places, et cetera, and had our solo work.
And even though George was the editor and helped, you know, sort of producer of the audio walks, they would be under my name because I was writing the scripts and all that. But then the video walks, we do them collaboratively because he thinks in visual terms of how the video works and everything like that. So it was a good relationship that way.
So we're kind of making a huge assumption that everyone's familiar with our work. How many people have seen any of our work at all? Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's better than the 20 volunteers who are working on the Ship of Fools. Only two had seen it. Okay, so we can make this huge assumption then.
Yeah. But I can talk a little bit about Dark Pool, because I think that's the closest to the Ship of Fools that we've done. We tend to work in series. We have a series of works that fall off from Whispering Room. We did the 40-part motet right after. Whispering Room is just bare speakers, basically, with voices coming out. 40-part motet was done 10 years later, and it's bare speakers. Then we did a piece just last year with 98 speakers called The Murder of Crows, and it's just basically speakers and some chairs. And so we have sort of this minimalist aesthetic, but at the same time we have this Baroque aesthetic, this completely over the top.
Maximalist.
Maximalist.
I like to call it.
Where we put everything in.
I want the old time when we could have those things, you know, put things in boxes. They're maximalists. Baroque maximalists.
You mean movements and stuff like that?
Baroque maximalists.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And do you want to show the clip of the Dark Pool?
Sure. And the Dark Pool, we saw it as kind of a workshop where two artists were working, or two scientists were working, then they sort of left the workshop, they closed the door and left it. And the Ship of Fools had the same kind of idea, that it was some sort of crazy workshop.
So this is
1995.
I can talk over here. Cool. 1995, this was at Western Front, the first show of it. And it kind of developed, and it just has a life of its own. It keeps showing all over. It's going to Dusseldorf now to show for a year at, what is
K-21.
It? K-21. So we wanted to make something that you felt. We were living in Alberta, and in 95, the Canadian art world was extremely clean at that time. And we wanted to make something that you almost felt like you didn't want to go in because it was so moldy. And we wanted to make something that you felt like you'd fallen out the back of the gallery, or you discovered a space that you really weren't supposed to be in. So when you come to this, there's a door. Sometimes there's a corridor. You go in, and your movement through the space triggers different sounds. So there's like a paper cup that you can hear Janet going, hello, hello.
I thought it was you saying hello.
Well, I think we, well, maybe it was. I can't remember.
I think it's on video.
Oh, is it on the video? Yeah. Okay, so this is the...
We have a short documentation video of this, okay. So maybe we should get to that soon.
Okay, and the floor is covered with cardboard, and it's just plastic. And okay, I'll show the video. I think it comes up.
Shadows of two people dancing.
I don't see anything.
They're in front of the tables, and they're waltzing around the room. Her head's on his shoulder. You can tell by the way he holds her that he loves her.
That's a nice story. I'm sorry I don't see it.
I can't hear you. Are you still there?
So that piece, it could be... basically silent, except for the tube and water going squish, squish, if you didn't move. But then when you moved around, the sound was censored. So that, but the Ship of Fools is basically a computer program that runs all the sound, all the machines and everything, and it's a 5-minute and 30-second loop, so that the computer's sort of hidden in the hull. And
so what's interesting about that is the I guess we should relate to performance, right? The spectator became a performer in the piece, much like your two-touch piece, where it's a table that has sensors in it, and you can kind of move your hands over it and trigger 18 different soundtracks. So with Dark Pool, it's the same thing. However you went through the space, you triggered different sounds, and you came up with a different kind of sound mix.
Because there are different ways of thinking about that type of engagement of a spectator. And I know that you're self-confessed control freaks, you know, as far as making the piece work in a certain way. Is there a sense in which that can be seen as manipulative, or is it not? I mean, are you totally open? Obviously, the spectator is constrained because they can't. In the Ship of Fools, you have to be very careful not to knock things over or touch them. So there's immersion and interactivity of a kind, but also
I mean, Ship of Fools is more controlled. Dark Pool, you could sit, you could read books. There was a whole library of books in there.
And people added their wishes.
The wish machine was quite fun, an actual working wish machine. You just put your wish between the two copper plates, and it will come true.
I think the issue of manipulation is an interesting one because we never think of it at all in terms of that. We think of it more about play, that there's games that have kind of rules, and it's like a kid's game when you put your eyes, or you're blindfolded and you're led around by somebody. Like some critics have called the audio walks about manipulation. They didn't want to be manipulated, so they stopped walking. Well, yeah, of course, you're totally free to stop walking. It's like, I don't want to play the game. But what other part of our society isn't manipulative? Mm. It's like we have sidewalks here, and there's a red light, there's a green light. But the aspect of play
is... And if you want to look at a painting, you have to stand in front of it.
You got to stand. I'm going to turn my back on this painting just because I can, you know. So we totally ignore that kind of thing. But to us, it raises the issue of the idea of interactive play, which we totally are interested in. We think it's a very important part of art making, the idea of magic, illusion, play, fun. And
I think we're really inspired by film is a totally manipulative medium, which I find I'm very frustrated with, but I love good films, but I hate bad films. But the ones that really... A good film totally manipulates you, but manipulates you in a way that you want to be manipulated.
That's
right? The ones that are bad manipulate you, and you know you're being manipulated, and you just hate it because it's just so badly done. You want to be manipulated in a good way. So...
And you know when the music's too sucky or whatever, that many Hollywood movies, they just totally make you sick with the music.
And yet you find yourself tearing up and then you feel pissed off that you're...
Exactly.
It's almost like an involuntary response.
I think in a way we also try and leave room for the viewer to really find other things in the work. I mean, we do manipulate, and we're control freaks, but we leave a lot of room for them to make their own story and to figure things out, which we rely on the intelligence of the viewer. Mm-hmm. And that's what's great in the art world. I mean, we can get away with a lot more than filmmakers can get away with in some way. I mean, I'm talking about Hollywood.
I think the issue of control is also very much about craft. Because if you relate it to an idea of painting or another field, in order to get your message across, you want to control, you know, where is this shape versus where is this shape? You know, it doesn't look good in the middle or something. You know, it doesn't, you know, so it's about craft. And we've worked very hard at, George is just a perfectionist when it comes to getting the right sound and, perfect sound. So it's that part of it is very controlled. So we want the experience for the viewer, participant, to be in that way.
Is there then a kind of a maybe indirect political dimension to that? In that it's obviously not an explicit critique of, you know, the surveillance of the art museum, which is on my mind. but I think indirectly then, by setting up play, it does something to that environment. I mean, that's what was so ironic about being treated that way by this guard, because it was so at odds with this kind of lyrical, dreamlike experience of the piece.
Yeah.
And at one point I just said, would you just leave me alone so I could see this artwork? Like, just get out of here, you know?
Uh-huh.
Because he was imposing what has become all too common a part of the art world, which is surveillance, channeling, rules, a lot of money, you know, all these things that art galleries are now about.
And that's why the interface is so important, because we found that the very first time Paradise Institute showed, we had someone who was a little too aggressive with the public, and you know it affects you the way you see the piece if you're not treated properly. So we're very we like to get the interface people to see the piece, enjoy it, and if people don't like it, then we don't want them involved with our work. So it's that sort of thing. But there's a lot we can't control now, and as the years have gone by, we've let a lot...
We're getting more laid back.
Much more laid back. Yeah. Maybe it's the Western Canada. It's like,
Well, once you...
Pot-growing nation.
Once you sell your work, you
do
lose.
We're not growing pot.
No.
you do to some degree lose control because now it's in a collection and short of constantly
and that's difficult.
The curators or what have you.
We have these big books that we send out to the when they buy a work that tells them exactly the spiel they're supposed to give, et cetera, et cetera.
But that's one of the oldest.
That's paradise. I mean, The Ship of Fools is great in a way for us because it controls itself. Only so many people can go through it. It's a fairly narrow. I don't know. How many people have seen The Ship? Oh, my God.
Oh, good for you. Yeah.
Excellent. Wow. Okay.
You were in there with the kids. There's not as many kids today. The first 2 days, it's like... Oh, yeah.
But anyway, so it controls itself. Yeah. I mean, we try and give them... I go up there and watch the people loading the piece, as I call it, loading the piece. But, I mean, they're doing a great job, and it controls itself. It can only take so many people. Right. People go a certain speed. The real problem was when we were doing installations like the Paradise Institute and, the Paradise Institute grew out of a piece called Playhouse, which was one person for 5 minutes with headphones inside of their own private opera loge. So 5 minutes, you kind of go, okay, so 5 minutes in an hour, that's, you can get how many people through?
Twelve
people. So you're at an opening.
I dropped math.
Traditional opening, 2 hours, so you can get 24 people through. You have 400 people at an opening. You have a lot of people very angry and or drunk. Anyway, so we changed it. We had to kind of work it that we had tickets, and we did a six-hour opening, and so we changed the whole format for that. But it was a nightmare. So then we were asked to do a project for the Istanbul Biennale. So we're like, oh, we can do this little cinema. We'll have three headphones. It'll be great. You know, they don't have to go in. They'll stand on the outside. So three people were thinking, that's great. So people are ripping the headphones off of the people in front of them, right? There's a scrum around the thing, and it's a huge nightmare. So then we go, okay, we were asked to do Venice. So we have, we think, wow, we would like to do another cinema piece because we were really happy with the Muriel Lake incident, just that only three people could watch it at a time. So we think 16 people, this is fantastic. We'll build a mini cinema, 16 people, that'll be great. Unfortunately, neither of us had ever been to Venice or seen the Biennale.
Yeah.
And
thousands.
So we did this piece, and the opening 3 days is an incredible nightmare of 5-hour lineups for our piece. So.
Well, that's flattering.
Well, it was flattering, but it was also a nightmare.
Yeah.
The whole crew had nervous breakdowns afterwards. Anyway, so Ship of Fools is. Anyways, I don't know how I got it.
Do you want to talk about go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, what's the legacy of these pieces? I forget who bought Paradise Institute.
Well, the National Gallery has one. It's a an edition,
so
actually.
It's an edition, yeah.
And
in
the
fact,
dark
we're
room?
The dark pool is non-edition.
No,
it couldn't be edition. So.
And we didn't want to sell it, so we're it's in our collection.
And what's going to happen with the Ship of Fools?
Well, it's slated to go to the Hebel Theater in Berlin after this. So, that's a good example too. The idea of performance, and the Germans are really open to hybrid media. Mm-hmm. We've worked with filmmakers who do first run theater or first run film stuff, and work with musicians, composers, everything over there. And everybody, like an artist, has a purpose in culture. Over there, so they don't think it's weird to be an artist. So,
whereas in Grindrod, they really think it's weird.
but the point is this: is that we did a video walk for the Hebel Theater in Berlin. It's actually showing right now again. They mount it whenever the theater might have like 4 or 5 days empty, and they just remount the lighting. They set the lighting the way it is, and then the video walk goes on.
So, video walk is maybe we should explain that. Janet did audio walks, which are binaural tours through various landscapes. And so at one point, we did these augmented audio walks that had these telescopes that would look out onto a street, and you'd see the telescope would be all pre-recorded, and it would actually move with a robotic head. And
I don't know how to work this.
Yeah, you better not touch that. I couldn't work it either. So what do you want to show?
I thought I'd put up some video walk thing.
Oh, okay.
No, that's okay.
We can do that. But anyway, so a video walk is you get a... I was going on with the telescope, so I'll just switch to the video walk. You get a camera instead of a...
When you get the picture up, I'll explain.
Okay, good.
You go into a site, and there's a camera, or an iVideo right now, to touch video. And
sorry, we're just going through our whole. This is just. This will be our talk in 2 days.
And it's pre-recorded video with three-dimensional audio on a particular site. There it is. And these are old cameras. This is the very first one that we did in 1997, I think. But now they're on iTouches. And it's a really weird experience because you see the same site that you're in on the video, but there's different people. So the architecture remains the same, but there's different people, and then the audio augments it. So we treat it as like a physical cinema, in that we have scripted parts with actors and everything on the screen, as well as in the audio, and then in this part there was actual performer on the video playing a piano, but at the same time there's someone doing the video walk on the stage. So in the screen you see that, and you want to put it together. Your brain says it has to sync up. So we've learned so much about the subtext. A lot of these audio walks teach us so much about how our brains work and how our senses really control our reality. And that's a big thing. For us is our perception of reality and how you can really fool with that and have fun with that.
Mm. It's really weird. These things are just incredibly weird because you really start to wonder what you wonder. The reality on the little screen, this 2.5-inch screen, becomes way more real to you than the outside reality, and you just can't figure out why the person there isn't actually standing there. So it's really, and it's great because in the Hebel, we wrote the director Matthias Lilienthal just gave us carte blanche to go anywhere we wanted to. And so we take them through the attic and then down through this curving stairway, and then they come out on the stage with the video camera, and there's a famous German actor standing there giving the soliloquy to them on the camera. And then the camera turns and you see that it's a full theater in the
full audience,
in the little screen. Right. And it's empty in reality. And so there's this weird... Mm. Anyways, you can do all kinds of interesting, crazy things with a video.
Well, I'm thinking of Ship of Fools gives this amazing sensation, of course, of actually being on the water through some pretty goofy but wonderful. There's a shanty being sung at one point.
That's my grandfather, 1966.
But then could you talk a little bit about the different levels in that specific case? Because there's an aquarium moving, and then there's also the sound of waves, and then the boat starts creaking and moving.
Yeah.
And
yeah, the creaking is our Tonmeister's door in Germany, in Berlin. He recorded that before he came over.
He used accordion straps too.
And the subwoofer we have, it's create engine noise. Mm. Really makes you feel like the boat's moving because it goes, it actually shakes. Mm-hmm. The vibration shake the whole floor.
Has this other component in that case of actual physical, sensory.
We weren't really thinking too much. I mean, with Ship of Fools, we weren't trying to go into that virtual kind of space, though. We weren't thinking so much about...
Not as much about a virtual performer like, say, Killing Machine or something, where you watch a performance, or opera for a small room where you sort of are aware of a performance.
I mean, a lot of our pieces are about that kind of trickery, that where we fool your reality, whereas I think the Ship of Fools is more our kind of magic realistic pieces that gives you so much stuff that you just, there's all these fascinating little things to look at, overwhelm the viewer with things that somehow adds up to a greater whole. Or a smaller hole. I'm not sure what.
But in terms of layers, what you're talking about, so there's the layers of this recorded sound. So we have waves, and we have singers. We have my daughter and I going, like totally gibberish. And then we have some creaking noise and things like that. And there's hidden speakers. And then there's some radios that we would sort of wanted the sort of old-fashioned sounds come out of. And then we have the sound of the machines.
Yes.
And then the sound of the water. And that's all choreographed so that it's a whole 5-minute and 30-second composition, basically. Because there's a quiet part, and then it gets crazy, and the galley starts.
The crew get angry at some point.
Mutiny. says, I think there's a really interesting interface between in Ship of Fools in each of your pieces it's different. The interrelationship between high technology and, you know, this completely crude, mechanical, low technology that's incredibly visible in Ship of Fools. But, of course, it's all driven by computer technology.
Yeah,
and
some
of the pieces are much more
like the banging
kind of slick
stuff
and high tech, but I love the kind of, you create this feeling of, you know, almost pre-industrial era of the great ships and so on, but with this hidden level of new media computer technology.
Yeah, we really, well, it's actually not even hidden if you look for it. There's the computer sitting there. But we kind of like to leave all that exposed in a way. But, yeah, and we're always, even the way we use computers is very low tech, I have to say. I mean, this was a crazy kind of virtue as well. Realistic virtual reality that you can create just using a video camera. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do it. And it's really, so we like those kind of solutions to problems, like where we can find something that's the lowest tech version of it. And we're really, with Ship of Fools, we're using off-the-shelf computer software, basically.
Yeah. And people are always asking us if we use Macs or something. Everybody probably here knows what Macs is. It's a high-tech.
We never use that. We use Macs, but not that software called Macs. It's really, why'd they name it that?
Yeah.
It's really...
So, yeah, I mean, each piece could be looked at purely in terms of that, the interface between different levels of technology and how it affects the person engaging it really interestingly.
Doesn't all that sort of, I think what right. really important was that you want the people to participate, to be part of what you're doing. And it seems to me that the sort of low-tech approach is very interesting because all of a sudden, it's so simple, and so all of a sudden, that's not the thing. It's trying to find out why, how you're doing it. Let's experience what's there. It seems to me it just opens to the
Maybe yeah. that's why. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, because the technology becomes invisible in the, say, the audio video walks, as well as, say, in 40-part motet, where people can walk up to the speaker and put their, we're in whispering room, they can walk up and get the intimacy. 40-part motet is a recorded choir where every speaker is one particular singer. So people get a, they really go right up to the singer and sit down next to them, whereas they, we thought about that a lot, and rather than making weird speakers or whatever, we just thought we put a regular speaker up there, and everybody's so used to them in our culture that they don't even see it.
Well, they see it, but they don't see it.
But it doesn't bother them.
Right.
It's not like
it's not intimidating.
It's not intimidating.
So they're quite happy
like putting on a helmet, a VR helmet or something. You're so aware of the actual technology that it's hard to see the content.
And then the actual film projector, which makes its own sound and in some cases with your work.
Yeah, the slide projector in the road trip. We have a can you show a picture of that?
Sure.
Because I think that's kind of there's a part of our work that is very, we learned from 40-part motet, the anthropomorphization of the audio speaker and how it really became a person and became a whole choir, a virtual choir of a 16th century piece of work. A piece of music.
There's that, what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about. But so then that led into other pieces like Opera for a Small Room, where, and this piece, which is Jimi Hendrix, we scored the Jimi Hendrix where he did the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock with all the feedback and everything, and we had it played back. We hired a guitarist to do it properly and played it back, and so it becomes a virtual performer of a guitar. It sounds just like someone's playing guitar, but you have to step on the wah-wah pedal to make it go. So you sort of become part of the experience too. And then this one, the two speakers, or one speaker, my voice comes out of, the other speaker, George's voice comes out of, and the slide projector is seemingly controlled by our voices.
So we go, we're talking about a slide, oh, that's Castle Mountain. And then the next slide, oh, I think that's Lake, whatever.
And then oh, no, I got it in the wrong order. And so George says, well, turn it back. And so we reverse it, but it seems like we're reversing. But, and it's all controlled by the, you know, what's it controlled by?
I don't remember. Small circuit. Not very, it's not very complicated.
It's not, I was thinking it's computer, but there's no computer there.
No, there's no computer. It's just a small, it's a tone on the, one of the audio tracks that controls the.
And so it does the same thing as the video walks. Your brain just can't figure quite it out because it seems like the voices are controlling it.
Especially when we rearrange the slides, which is a little sleight of hand. I'm going like, we're supposed to be going across the country. How'd you get the slides in this order? We actually recorded this. And it was a real type of thing where
it was a real conversation where we were arguing.
Janet, like, it's supposed to be a road trip. We should be going in order. Now we're in Northern Ontario. We should be in Calgary by now. And anyway, so then she says, well, do you want to reorder the slides? And I go, okay. So then the projector goes back through all the slides that we've been through, which is actually going forward, showing the same slides. And then it goes blank. And then we have a fumbling 5 minutes of in the like, dark. And then
They say it's a mind screw up.
Yeah. Anyways, because people are always just staring at the projector and like, how can that happen? What's going on?
So, new question.
New question. I think
we're just rambling.
Now's the time, probably.
Yeah, to open it.
Thanks to your opening, to turn on the lights and invite the audience to engage.
That would be great.
So wake up.
So any questions? There's one.
I'm wondering with the video walk, the way that you describe sort of the immersive power of the video screen, if that is really being augmented by the fact that it's the sounds in headphones. If it was coming out of the screen on a smartphone, would we have that same sort of falling into that image? Or is it because, for me, the audio is something which is, it's in the body, right?
Yeah.
And what we're looking at is out here. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if that's part of
it. Well, it's true, the audio is really powerful in those walks as well, but the funny thing is you really don't even notice the audio. When you're going through a video walk, you lose track that this audio isn't real, as well because it's recorded binaurally, the same as the audio walks. But it's because we really learned that our vision is so much more powerful than our hearing or like our sense of it. Our vision overtakes all of our senses. And so this little tiny screen becomes such a powerful thing that in the video walks we often just turn it off. And then all of a sudden you're aware that, oh, there's a guy walking up behind me on the binaural audio track. And then you get this kind of tingle of, well, who's that? You know, and there's nobody there. And that you start hearing those sounds a lot more clearly after we shut the video image off. But you're
and
right.
We didn't
the video,
know that before
the video,
we
the sound really enhances it. I mean, every filmmaker knows that the sound is so important. But it's also because we don't intellectually put a barrier up to sound. The sound goes through us in a way that nothing else does. So that it's behind everything in a way.
I know some
familiar,
of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And you were trying to create something, what I look like, purple hair. And the auditory people, when you're trying to decide what they're going to say, would look to the right. And if they were trying to remember what somebody said, and if they were trying to recreate it, they'd look to the left. And kinesthetic people look down to the right. So that when you're designing your pieces, it would be very interesting for you to look at their work.
We to videotape
have, we
ourselves.
We should have cameras on our heads.
Also, see. They claim that each of us has a dominant channel.
Uh-huh. So,
I would wonder about
sound.
Those separating those out. I'd be quite suspicious. I don't, you know, I think there's been a tendency in the past to separate out vision, for example, in visual theory. But
the other, like I'm very visual, but I'm also auditory. So if someone is a docent is talking in front of a painting, I have to walk away because it overloads. So it affects how you're seeing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's helped, a lot of studies have helped out with child education, realizing that some children just can't hear. Like they see it. If it's written on the board, it's okay, but they don't hear it, or vice versa or something. Yeah.
This question over here.
Yeah, I just finished writing a very large document on your work.
Hope you got a good mark.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I was really struck in all the criticism and catalogs by there's a formula which, you know, you can't blame people who are writing about it, where specifically there's usually about 50, 60, 75% that's description, which is not the case with writing about all kinds of artwork, but with this kind of complicated, immersive, and sometimes narrative or always narrative kind of work, people spend a lot of time just describing it. Mm-hmm. And then there's usually a few very similar analytical tropes that get thrown out.
Yeah, I think it's super difficult to show the work unless you've experienced it. And the best audiences are some people who have experienced our work. Because when we first started working, you know, we describe the Audi walks and people go, ah, you know, yeah, I've had tour guides in museums, you know, but it's not the same. Mm. So that we've worked really hard on ideas of documentation, how we can show the viewer point of view and then the point of view of what they're seeing and then trying to combine those two. And
so the website, obviously, for those of you who haven't looked at their website, it's one of the best, you know, very, very elaborate. Lots of very clear documentation. But at the same time, just to be provocative, I could say, well, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of wanting people to know the work as an experience rather than as a document?
Well, the problem is a lot of our works are fairly specific to site. Mm-hmm. And so that unless people go to Italy to see this, they don't see it. So what we've done is we've tried to concentrate on some documentation and then put in a lot of the catalogs recently, we've had DVDs in it. But yeah, translating to text is really hard. But you said an interesting thing. I'll just segue here with when you're writing about it, you found that the experience of, you know, tripping or something was important. And with the walks, I always found it interesting that they're never the same artwork for anyone, right? Because one person goes along and they experience a whole new world that then the next person trips, right? Or and when they were on cassettes in 1997 when it was in sculpture projects, they actually, you know, sometimes the battery would wear down and then one guy would say, that was a weird voice. It was kind of like a male's voice, wasn't it? And it was really slow, you know, so it's, but I like that aspect. But yeah, I mean, George does I think he does amazing documentation because, like, right now he's shooting the boat, and that's a hard thing to shoot. The
so does that change the way you're making work now that you're...
No.
Or not? I mean, maybe you've always...
No, we're frustrated with documentation. We're always frustrated with it, and so we always say, take our word for it. This sounds really good when you see it. But, I mean, that's another reason we don't do a lot of talks, even though we're doing two this week.
And people ask us for CDs of, say, Murder of Crow or for 40 Part Motet. And we actually attempted to do a CD of 40 Part Motet, and we listened to it and we said, no, can't do it. I mean, better to buy one of, you know, the New York Symphony or whatever doing it, or the New York Choir. So it's, and same thing with 98 speakers. You know, you can't translate that to two speakers. You just can't.
Yeah,
so we have snippets sometimes to give an idea, but we don't...
So in some cases, you need to make the choice not to represent it in that
way. Yeah, exactly.
Because it would really betray...
But it works better for even the pieces like Murder Crows or 40-Part Motet that are just sound. It works better to have a video image of walking around.
Yeah.
Because then people can go into the video image, and their bodies can sort of be encompassed in that, and they can... understand that the sound is coming out of this speaker and that speaker.
Well, it's more of an indication rather than, you know, a reproduction.
But I don't know about I guess it's just the talent of the writer. Yes. One person over there. Yeah.
Who's in charge? I should let you do that.
So she's there first, and then you next. I think you're looking there.
I have a question about
It varies. It varies. In 1995 or something, or early on in our careers, I was teaching, so we could afford the technology. 1991, I think, I got a full-time job, so we could afford our habit of buying technology. And then the walks, like, who would have known it? You know, that then museums wanted to buy them. And we could sell a lot, but we don't do audio walks anymore. So back then, we used to apply for grants and things to fund the work, and then when collectors started buying them, then that's great. But some site-specific projects we do, like with Luminata, it's a fee, because, you know, what do you do with a boat? Well, we're hoping to sell it, but...
Yeah, we don't apply a lot for grants anymore. We feel guilty.
Basically. We leave that for the younger artists.
But, yeah, we're surprised that there are so many people wanting to purchase our works, which is fantastic. So, like, this piece is an edition of three, and it's sold out, so it's...
And it's a fairly difficult piece, yeah.
So, yeah, that's how we fund our work, sales. And if you want to buy one, no problem.
Okay, here.
What's next?
A holiday. Actually, no, George has to go to Japan in about a week. We're doing a piece called Storm Room there, and we did it as a site-specific piece in a tree and alley last summer. And then we made it into an installation piece, and it showed for the opening of the Alberta Gallery of Art in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. It's a room you walk in, and there's actual storm. You can look on YouTube.
Now we're putting it in a house on an island.
Somebody wanted it as a permanent piece.
As part of the festival.
So they wanted to buy it as a permanent piece, part of their collection. So they got us a house, and we're making a storm house.
Pardon?
Yeah, Naoshima bought it. Yeah.
Naoshima, yeah.
Benesi Corporation.
But they're putting on Toshima instead because they don't have enough.
It's a Satuchi Triennale.
They're getting more islands involved, so they want people to have to go to different islands now. It's enough to get to Naoshima.
But after that
holiday. Take another boat.
Holiday, except that we're supposed to do a show at the AGO in February. This will be our first.
Another question there.
Yeah, and I think this might be the last question because we're moving towards the end of our time.
So. Oh, yeah, it's 5:07. Yeah, we're over.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you had a better experience than I did. Thank you.
That's an ergonomic issue that's come up over and over again, actually, and it's hard to estimate a speaker height. And I think that would mean that they've mixed it too low. It should be so that it should, the volume should be higher so that you can hear it. If you even can't get your ear into the cone of the speaker, you should be able to hear it if you're at least 2 feet below it. So that makes me think that they're not mixing it high enough.
Well, I hate to say it, but there are hearing issues as you get older. So it is a question of varied embodiments. And so not, you know, there's also the huge issue of personal experience and individual memory, but also just the way you carry your body and your body's capabilities and, the, you know, how it hears and how it sees and how it moves.
But I think about accessibility because I grew up in a farm. My parents have a farm 2 hours west of here. They knew nothing about art, but they sort of like what we do. You know, they can get into it. They don't have any art education. And they get into it. Our kids come and they can enjoy the Ship of Fools.
Mm. Which is a bit scary to me that it's so successful with the people just going to Trinity Bellwoods Park. I'm not sure.
It's good to be part of a conference like this with, you know, intellectuals and theorists and performers and that. I think the technology aspect and the interaction aspect makes it accessible to the general public.
And I think it's amazing you got away with doing it without a lot of legal disclaimers. And
yeah, there's no, yeah.
It's like, no, yeah.
Well, that's Luminato. They didn't want to have
content,
I was saying, shouldn't we have a sign a release or something, you know, because they could
good
trip.
For them.
And they just said, no, we're not going to do that. So.
I mean, and we could end by going back to that problem of what's happened in a lot of cases with the visual arts becoming more and more corporatized and directed and surveyed. And, you know, so it's wonderful to have this piece there in the park that's just there and it's available to anyone who happens to go to the park.
It's a great site.
And to 10 at night, which is cool.
Yeah, Robert, way to go.
So, those of you who haven't seen it, go enjoy, and thank you for coming.